This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, after decades of nonviolent public feeding the homeless, Food Not Bombs has a victory in the 11th Circuit. Founder Keith McHenry joins us to discuss the decision by three justices who held that outdoor food sharing is expressive conduct protected by the First Amendment. Author and attorney Greg Lukianoff discusses his new book, The Coddling of the American Mind. He asserts that we're setting up an entire generation for failure, albeit with good intentions. Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian. In a remarkable victory for free speech, in late August, three 11th Circuit judges held that the Fort Lauderdale Food Not Bombs weekly outdoor food sharing is expressive conduct. As such, it is protected by the First Amendment. The Florida group is affiliated with the international organization Food Not Bombs and engages in peaceful political direct action. It conducts weekly food sharing events at Stranahan Park in downtown Fort Lauderdale, distributing vegetarian or vegan food free of charge. In the decision, the three justices wrote of Food Not Bombs that, quote, "The message is that society can end hunger and poverty if we redirect our collective resources from the military and war, and that food is a human right, not a privilege, which society has a responsibility to provide for all. Providing food in a visible public space and sharing meals with others is an act of political solidarity meant to convey the organization's message." The justices disagreed with the lower court's ruling that food sharing events are not expressive conduct because the act of feeding is not inherently communicative of Food Not Bombs' quote, intended, unique, and particularized message. Food Not Bombs was founded in the early 80s by Keith McHenry and seven friends in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Now nearly 40 years old and going strong, Food Not Bombs has hundreds of autonomous chapters around the world. Keith McHenry tells us how he got the original idea.
You know, there's like three basic things that happened. And the first was I was a produce worker at Bread and Circuits in Cambridge, and I just felt horrible. I was throwing out this organic produce. And then start just taking it to the housing projects a couple blocks away. And across the street, there was this new building, and the residents at the projects were saying, oh, that's where they design nuclear weapons. And I go, wow, that's really crazy. You're struggling to survive on this side of Portland Avenue in Cambridge, and they're making nuclear weapons on the other side in a brand new glass building. And that's inspired me to have to think of the name Food Not Bombs. And then a friend of ours was arrested, a law student, Brian Fiegenbaum, studying law at Boston University, was arrested at an anti-nuclear protest. We're trying to shut down Seabrook Nuclear Power Station. And that was on May 24th, 1980. And the eight of us that became Food Not Bombs united on that day as his legal defense team. And what we thought to do was to raise money for his legal defense by doing bake sales, which were completely unsuccessful. And I happened to find a poster that said, wouldn't it be a beautiful day if the schools had all the money they needed and the Air Force had to hold a bake sale to buy a bomber? And so we dressed up as soldiers and took that poster out with us and told people we were trying to raise money for a bomber, and then we would eventually tell them, of course, once we got their attention, that about the anti-nuclear protest and Brian's case. And then the final thing that really became what is now what people think of as Food Not Bombs is we decided to dress up as hobos and organize a soup kitchen outside the stockholders meeting of the Bank of Boston. The Bank of Boston was investing in nuclear industry and in nuclear war. And that was right when Reagan is coming to power. And so we thought, wow, all these policies of the bank and of Reagan are likely to lead to a future where there'll be homeless people needing food at soup kitchens like in the Great Depression. So we decided to have this street theater as hobos. And then we realized we really didn't have a lot of people likely to show up because we had done some poor advertising in advance. So I went to the Pine Street Inn and gave a speech to the homeless people there, the homeless man, about the protest the next day. And they showed up, and those homeless guys suggested we do it every day because there was no food for homeless people at that time in Boston, because the economy was not in the shambles we see it today. So that's what we decided to do. We just gave notice at our jobs and started collecting food, taking it to housing projects in a systematic way all around the Boston area, and then doing street theater with vegan meals in Harvard Square, at the Boston Commons, and at protests and so on throughout New England.
Several court decisions have likened Food Not Bombs to traditional feeding programs for the homeless. Keith explains a bit more how the organization differs from groups such as churches and soup kitchens.
People will go, particularly in courts, in federal courts and state courts, will side with city governments that we're nothing more than a charity. And therefore, we should go indoors. And this is a common refrain. I first heard this in 1988 in San Francisco, when the mayor and the police said that, oh, if you want to feed the homeless, we'll give you a place at the Armory out by the beach, and you can truck, we'll have buses take the homeless to the Armory. And then we explained that we're not a charity, that we're actually dedicated to nonviolent social change, to change society so no one has to eat at a soup kitchen or live in the streets. And being forced into an indoor building or a remote part of the city where no one will walk by does not actually help our goals and our efforts, because we have all along, as our history shows, at the beginning where we're doing street theater, our idea was to communicate with the public that our resources would be better spent on human needs like education, healthcare, other social services, than spending nearly 50 cents of every tax dollar on the military, and that would make America much more secure, and many other related issues around the environment, around racism, homophobia, civil rights, animal rights. These kinds of things we're trying to express by having our meals out in public with banners and signs and literature. And so we've been arguing that in courts for years and to the media that our message is as important as the meals, that it's all one package, and that part of the impact of the meals is the fact that people come, walk down the street, they see a group of people eating food. They then see the sign Food Not Bombs. They meet us and get our literature. And they're motivated more strongly because of the impact of all of those things together to support actions that would divert military funding towards civilian needs.
As part of delivering this message, most of the food served by Food Not Bombs is salvaged from grocery stores, bakeries, and markets that would otherwise go to waste. Food merchants have varied responses to requests for surplus food.
We have found that particularly the larger chain stores like Albertsons, Safeway, Piggly Wiggly, and so on, they will say, oh, we are concerned about liability, and therefore we can't donate food to you. But the reality is that Clinton administration, at the time he was doing so-called welfare reform, which has been devastating for the poor in the United States, threw out a bone to opponents of his welfare reform program in a legislation that was called the Good Samaritan Act. So no one actually is liable for being sued if they give unsafe food to an organization like Food Not Bombs and then somebody is made ill. But the reality is, research has been done by a number of different universities in the United States in this matter, and so far no one has sued any grocery store or food establishment for having shared unsafe food to someone living on the streets or someone who was hungry. So this is just completely a myth that is not based in any reality. And it's like a lot of myths that we have in the area of homelessness, like the myth that if you have good services in your town, all the homeless will travel to your town. Or that if you feed the hungry outside in the streets, homeless people won't go to indoor food programs where they could get job training and drug and alcohol treatment. Things that they're just not founded. But there is an entire kind of mythology around the reality of homelessness that is definitely not based in my experience of feeding people for 40 years on the streets.
Well, food providers may not have been sued. The organization Food Not Bombs has been many times. The first arrests for sharing free food occurred 30 years ago on August 15, 1988, at the entrance to San Francisco's Golden Gate Park. 9 people, including Keith, were arrested that day. The city went on to make over 1,000 arrests of Food Not Bombs volunteers, and Amnesty International declared them to be, quote, prisoners of conscience. Keith recalls those early arrests.
We had had no conflict with the Boston or Cambridge authorities sharing free food. So I thought when we're going to San Francisco, that's America's most liberal city, and we'll just find the best location and the highest visibility and at a time that would meet the greatest need. And so in the Haight-Ashbury neighborhood, there were free meals for the hungry every day except Monday. So we started to set up at 12 noon at the entrance to Golden Gate Park. And then we were approached by someone I later found out was the director of the Haight-Ashbury Soup Kitchen, and who urged us to, said we could just get a permit to do this if we talk to the Parks Department. So on July 11th of 88, I wrote a letter to the Parks Department requesting a street performer's permit similar to the one that we had had in Cambridge. And we did not hear anything back until August 15th of 88, when about 45 riot police came out of Golden Gate Park and arrested 9 of us for sharing food. And that became, in the next 4 weeks, a total of 94 arrests, and the mayor freaked out because he was getting global news coverage about this, and agreed to meet with myself and the ACLU and local community activists to come up with a solution. And he made a temporary permit available so that we could continue to serve food, but that became a huge fiasco, which also involved the Environmental Health Department, which intentionally did everything it could to keep a food safety permit out of our reach. Eventually, I sued the city in federal court before Judge Peckham, who ordered them to give us the Environmental Health Permit, which would then make it possible to have the Recreation and Parks Permit continued, which was a lot of the struggle. However, the Health Department had a clever plan to get rid of the permit, and what they did is when assembling the health inspected tent in front of City Hall, a person came with a sheet of cake that was already cut into pieces, and then the police sent a homeless person to come and take one of the slices of cake, and the health inspector then ruled that somebody had eaten from our table when we didn't have our health permit properly displayed on the tent. And that really led us ultimately to come to the decision that we would never apply for a permit or accept a permit from any government agencies. And that became our global policy first in October of 92 at a first world gathering, and then was reaffirmed in 1995 at the second gathering, which involved probably around 200 to 250 people who came to consensus that we would never accept or apply for a permit again, considering it was being used as a way, an excuse to shut down our food program.
Keith talks a bit more about the so-called feeding bans and what he really thinks is behind some of these laws.
You know, there's at least 70 cities have bans or severe regulations against feeding the hungry outside. And in each of the cases, most recently, we can see that there was the case in Tampa or the case in Fort Lauderdale, where we had just won this 11th Circuit Court of Appeals case. The message that city officials have is that we should be not serving food in public because we're a charity, and they want us to be out of sight. And in most cases, the issue is that the city governments don't want any political pressure by seeing the visible presence of large numbers of people depending on groups like Food Not Bombs to get food, to actually spend their resources on solutions to homelessness. So from their perspective, usually encouraged by the local business community and the real estate industry, they create laws that make it intentionally impossible to serve free food outside in a public venue. In the last couple of months, there's been a really clear case of this, where it's not really an ordinance, but just political pressure in Santa Monica, where an anti-homeless organization, and almost every city in the country now has these anti-homeless groups, organized a campaign to have us forced out of our kitchen, our commercial kitchen at the Presbyterian Church, and forced off the street. And they cite, actually, in an interview in the local Santa Monica paper, that the reason is that people would not rent or lease some of the buildings along the 3rd Street Promenade because of the presence of homeless people and the Food Not Bombs meal. And they were driven inside to a Salvation Army, unfortunately, where they've been allowed to cook, but they have to share the food inside. And so it defeats the entire goals of Food Not Bombs as a direct result. But that's a classic case. And virtually all 70 cities, in all 70 cities, the goal of the city was to hide the problem of homelessness and to discourage people congregating to discuss these solutions and to organize political pressure for cities to do away with things like bans on sleeping, laws attacking people for asking for money, the many, many horrible things that municipalities do to attack their homeless community rather than invest in housing and social services, the kinds of things that really, would be at least partial solution. And, of course, the main solution to ending homelessness in the United States is to change the national priority away from spending 50 cents of every tax dollar on the military to investing in our communities and in the infrastructure and education and health care of our people.
Three justices from the 11th Circuit Court wrote that, quote, Fort Lauderdale's Food Not Bombs outdoor food sharing is expressive conduct protected by the First Amendment. We have no doubt that Fort Lauderdale Food Not Bombs intended to convey a certain message. Keith McHenry talks about his reaction to this favorable Fort Lauderdale court decision.
When I read this decision, I was shocked. It was as though we had written that decision ourselves. It was the same argument we have been making for 30 years about the connection between our message and how we organize in public. And it was probably even better than what we would have written ourselves, in that they quoted Macbeth, Shakespeare's Macbeth. They talked about the Boston Tea Party. It was just an incredible decision. So some of the things that, we just could not have written it better ourselves. They actually, one point, go, history may have been quite different had the Boston Tea Party been viewed as a mere dislike for certain brew and not a political protest against the taxation of the American colonies without representation. I mean, that's just among the poetic statements that Judge Jordan wrote in the 11th Circuit's decision. And it just goes right to the heart. What's so interesting is we have been arguing this case, which these justices expressed, on our behalf for years, and it flies in the face of of what city governments have traditionally done, which is to quote Clark versus Community for Creative Nonviolence, which claimed that Mitch Snyder, the homeless advocate in Washington, D.C., tent city in front of the White House was not expressive speech, that there was sleep and then there was expressive protest. And so you could sit in front of the White House and have with a permit to have a tent, but if you fell asleep, you would that would not be considered free speech. Or in the case of Ward, the Rock Against Racism, which is often used by city governments to declare that sharing free food is not expressive speech. But these justices really came out with some amazing statements. And one that I thought was particularly touching is they talk about the First Amendment right to burn a flag. And in the Dallas case at the Republican National Convention, of which one of the Food Not Bombs, a person who became a Food Not Bombs volunteer, Matt Dodd, was one of the people involved in that case. It's like the flag, the significance of sharing meals with others dates back millennia. The Bible recounts that Jesus shared meals with tax collectors and sinners to demonstrate that they were not outcasts in his eyes. In 1621, pilgrims and Native Americans celebrated the harvest by sharing the first Thanksgiving in Plymouth. So these are, while I would not totally agree with some of these details, the fact that Chief Justice Jordan of the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals used those as examples of the importance of communicating our political ideas through the sharing of free food is pretty remarkable.
National Lawyers Guild attorneys in Florida represented Food Not Bombs in this recent decision. Guild members have also represented the organization from coast to coast over the years. Keith reflects on what the Guild has meant to Food Not Bombs.
National Lawyers Guild has been key to our ability to defend ourselves in these cases. So, for instance, we in the 1,000 arrests in San Francisco, the National Lawyers Guild members created a team of roughly 45 attorneys to not only defend us in criminal cases. At one point we had a total of 750 felony conspiracy to violate a court order against sharing free food without a permit. Without the National Lawyers Guild, we would have been sunk. Probably one of the most famous National Lawyers Guild legal observers for Food Not Bombs is the CNN host Van Jones, who can be seen in surveillance tape arguing with the police and in our defense during a mass arrest at a time when I was facing 25 to life in prison in San Francisco in 1994. And National Lawyers Guild green hats can be seen at the arrests of Food Not Bombs in Orlando, at the arrests of Food Not Bombs in Fort Lauderdale, at events in Houston, Texas, where we were threatened with arrest. And you could see the green hats of the National Lawyers Guild at, you know, at rest in Tampa, Florida. Everywhere we have been where we're being threatened with arrest or sometimes police violence, you can find the National Lawyers Guild on the front line standing with us.
In the 1980s, filmmaker Richard Kaplan, one of Keith's roommates in Boston, made a short film about Food Not Bombs' graffiti efforts called The Sidewalk Sector. Keith recalls how the group would show passers-by images of atomic cloud bombs on the sidewalks and ask for their reactions. He recalls what some of the people said.
For a number of years, I went out and I put this Mushroom Cloud Today stencil on as many places as I could with friends who would also go out with me and lay down, and we would trace them in chalk and make dead bodies. Richard Kaplan was a Food Not Bombs activist as well as a filmmaker, and he followed us around. And the people afterwards, after we would do the graffiti, I would go out with Richard and interview people as they walked by. And some people would exclaim, "Oh, that's just awful, this graffiti." And then other people would say, you go, "Wow, yeah, I guess we could have a nuclear attack today. That's very interesting." And then some people asked if it was some kind of a Rochard chest or something like that. So it was the reactions were quite humorous, and it was really fun doing this documentary with Richard and getting the impression. And the documentary was a contrast between street art that we were doing against the war in El Salvador and against the threat of nuclear war, and the art of the banks and their logos and the other kind of sterility that corporate America was sort of foisting on the American public, and the contrast between those two things. That graffiti and campaign ended up becoming an inspiration for a play called Murder Now by Boston Theater Works, and a number of people actually traced the stencil and made their own stencil and got arrested in their towns. And when Richard and I were arrested for doing the graffiti, they confiscated his camera and the film, and then we had a court case at the Boston Municipal Courthouse, and we advertised it as the DA's Delight because we had filmed ourselves doing our own criminal vandalism, and we invited the public to come and had hoped that the DA would develop the footage of our graffiti actions and show it in court, and that would become even an added dimension of this street theater that we're trying to do. Sadly, the DA didn't develop the film. Richard had to develop him himself, but the good thing was that the charges were dropped against all of us.
Food Not Bombs has a theory of nonviolence that seems especially relevant now.
Our idea of nonviolent direct action is rooted, originally, I was inspired by Thoreau's Night in Jail for refusing to pay the poll tax that would fund the war in between the United States and Mexico and funded a government that supported slavery. And that led me to be interested in Gene Sharpe's work on nonviolent direct action. I was, of course, inspired by the Civil Rights Campaign by Martin Luther King and SNCC and others. And so when we started Food Not Bombs, we decided that, of course, being nonviolent was a core principle. And because nonviolence was a core principle of ours, we were organizing, of course, against bombs and for food, we also saw that the violence against animals was equally as the violence of war. So this is why our food is vegan. The other thing is that we, because we wanted to be consistent with all of our decisions around nonviolence. And then we also, in our nonviolence statement that we eventually published in San Francisco in the early 90s, pointed out that the society itself is violent in that poverty is violence. And so we wanted to connect all of these forms of violence through exploitation as being linked. And so that is a large portion of the message of Food Not Bombs and why we are out on the street trying to organize. Because I think people don't connect the violence of the meat industry and dairy industry with the violence of war and with the violence of poverty and the violence of sexism and homophobia and racism. That these violence acts of violence are all intertwined, supporting an economic and political system that's really just to the advantage of a small ruling elite, as now called the 1% after Occupy, and that is our message, that we are against violence of all kinds, including the institutional violence of the economic and political system itself, and that we strive to create a nonviolent future by taking nonviolent action ourselves.
For listeners who are interested in getting involved with Food Not Bombs or creating a local chapter, Keith tells them what to do.
Food Not Bombs is active today in roughly 1,000 cities of the world in over 65 countries. No matter what part of the world you're listening in, you can get involved with Food Not Bombs by going to foodnotbombs.net.
Keith McHenry, you are a true visionary, a humanitarian, and one of the founders of the international organization Food Not Bombs. Thank you so much for being with us on Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much for having me.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Within the past 5 years or so, American colleges and universities have been dealing, often quite publicly, with issues related to free speech on campus. In a widely read opinion piece in The Atlantic in 2016, attorney Greg Lukianoff and Jonathan Haidt argued that American students are being coddled as administrators cede to their demands for protection from offensive ideas and words. The authors wrote that requests to be shielded from such offensive words and behaviors comes at the expense of both intellectual rigor and the First Amendment. 2 years later, professors are still eliminating controversial matter from their classes to avoid facing so-called bias incident reports. College administrators are disinviting speakers whose viewpoints they feel may make students feel, quote, unsafe. And many students are afraid themselves to talk or write openly out of fear they might face public shaming. Lukianoff and Haidt have teamed up once again in writing the newly published book, The Coddling of the American Mind, How Good Intentions and Bad Ideas Are Setting Up a Generation for Failure. The book lays out the continued assault on free speech on U.S. campuses and the disservice that does by treating students as fragile. It also examines how conditions have worsened with external polarizing politics. And the authors offer several concrete suggestions for change. We're delighted to welcome back First Amendment attorney Greg Lukianoff to discuss his new book. Greg is also author of the 2014 book, Unlearning Liberty, Campus Censorship and the End of American Debate. Greg, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thanks so much for having me again.
Well, congratulations on your new book.
Thank you. Yeah, it was when John Haidt and I wrote the original article, we felt pretty good about, you know, leaving it be at The Atlantic. But some of the trends we noted there just kept on getting deeper and more concerning.
In the book, you and Jonathan talk about what you call the three great untruths. And
right.
The first is what doesn't kill you makes you weaker. Tell
right.
us about this and the other two.
Well, the whole idea of the great untruths is partially the negative advice that my family practices. And what I mean by that is that my family, we tend not to give positive advice. We don't say don't do that or some kind of aphorism. We usually make fun of what the bad choice would be to a degree. And in a hyper-polarized society, I think we may not be able to agree on what bad advice, what good advice looks like, but maybe, just maybe, we can agree on what terrible advice looks like. And so the first one is what doesn't kill you makes you weaker. And, of course, that's a play on Nietzsche's what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. Now, I'm no big fan of Nietzsche, but there's truth in the idea that challenging yourself is really can be really important to, you know, developing a sense of autonomy, confidence, all of these kind of essential psychological habits. And so we talk about in the book, what we talk about is that both ancient wisdom and modern psychology advocate for the position that essentially you need a certain amount of stressors in your life to develop a sense of, you know, maturity, agency, all these things that help you be not depressed, to have a locus of control, all of this kind of stuff. But it does sometimes seem like in current American society, we are so obsessed with safety that we've forgotten that there is a level at which you're actually harming yourself by keeping yourself from challenge and from things that used to be as innocent as, for example, free play.
You also say that always trust your feelings, and life is a battle between good and evil people. How did that come into the modern lexicon?
Sure. Always trust your feelings is probably the one that sounds the nicest, that most people are like, well, that sounds good. I should always trust my feelings. But if you look at, you know, ancient philosophy, whether Western or Eastern, whether you look at modern psychology, and I'm a huge proponent of cognitive behavioral therapy, that essentially just going with what your feelings tell you is not always the right answer. And in fact, if you only do exactly what your feelings tell you to, it can get you in a heck of a lot of trouble. So even though it sounds kind of seductive, for me, as someone who actually had very serious issues throughout my lifetime with depression and anxiety, learning the habits of cognitive behavioral therapy, where you look at the sort of crazy things your voice, you know, the voices in your head say to you sometimes, you know, like some minor incident can happen, you know, a date might go poorly, and suddenly you're saying to yourself, I'm going to die alone. And cognitive therapy is mostly about talking back to those kind of voices in your head, not with the power of positive thinking, but just with, come on, Greg, is that really realistic? Just rationally analyzing them. The third great untruth, the dualism one, that life is divided into good people and bad people, is really kind of one of the major sort of additions to the book that makes it so distinct from the article we wrote back in 2015. And we felt we had to add that because one of the things that we see happening not just on campus, not just in K-12, but certainly in the nation as a whole, is sort of a runaway polarization spiral. And this long predated Trump. Of course, since Trump has been in office, it's only accelerated all that much more. What we think is happening is we're playing to our kind of natural kind of tribalism, where essentially, you know, it's very easy to, social psychology, to create a sense of opposition between two groups. Even if they look the same, even if they're from the same class, you give people things as simple as a red shirt and a blue shirt, and within a couple hours they think of you guys as the enemy. And so that's talking about polarization is probably a topic that I find the most interesting in recent discussion.
Now, you assert in your book, and I do want to say that I think it's different and wonderful that you've incorporated this cognitive behavioral therapy component, because it really gets to the crux of the matter. Basically, that is that many students in this country are learning to think in distorted ways that increase their chance of becoming fragile, anxious, and easily hurt. One of the things that first sparked my interest into where we are was the use of the term trigger warning several years ago. Can you talk, what is a trigger warning? What does it mean?
Trigger warnings, they're one of these things that they're controversial almost completely out of proportion to the extent to which we think they're actually used on campus.
Right.
But trigger warnings are, they've become this sort of symbolic issue. Trigger warnings in theory are little, usually verbal warnings that you give in a classroom, for example, before you're about to present something that could have, you know, the classic example would be a graphic depiction of rape, out of sympathy for people who might have PTSD having personally experienced sexual assault themselves. So that's kind of like the model of what trigger warnings how they're usually explained. And understood like that, I don't blame anybody for thinking these are compassionate, these are well-intentioned, what could possibly be wrong with them? And one thing that I just have to explain over and over again when I speak on campus is, one, there's no evidence they are actually helpful to students or people with PTSD. Two, there is mainstream scientific reason to think that they could actually make things worse. And that may seem, that may seem counterintuitive, but there was a study recently done, it's by no means conclusive, but saying that students who were given trigger warnings, in some cases actually made them more anxious. But when you think about it for a little bit, it starts to make sense. It's kind of like the scary music playing in a horror film that essentially, yeah, of course, you might be kind of more anxious if someone is telling you flat out there's a reason to be afraid. And then there's the third fact, and one of the reasons why there's such a divide between some professors and some students over trigger warnings is that professors themselves were saying, I don't know what I'm supposed to warn students about. There seems to be sort of a slippery slope problem here that, sure, I can start by trying to address, you know, some of these very real, very common problems, but next thing you know, I'm being scolded for showing, as someone I know had the experience of, showing an interview from the 1970s that didn't sort of comport to modern sort of the campus norms, and being scolded by a student for not providing a trigger warning before it. And, you know, he felt like, I don't know what I can do. I can't really teach the material related to what I do without having some stuff that's going to be troubling.
And that brings us to the term coddling. Is overprotection a part of the recent trend on college campuses?
It's kind of funny. I fought the title coddling both when it was the name of the Atlantic article, and I fought it to the very last minute when Penguin wanted to make it the title of the book. Partially because people read it as simply saying people are spoiled, and that's how people tend to react to it. So we're at least in the book. We try to explain all we mean is sort of the older meaning of coddling, which is overprotection. That essentially, and we really emphasize this. It's actually in the second part of the title. Well-intentioned, compassionate attempts to protect our children in many cases do have negative unforeseen consequences. And, you know, there's a great sort of metaphorical real example that Haidt really wanted to use was when he was bringing his kids into, pre-kindergarten, there was a ban on any nut products. And the more he looked into the research, even though there was nobody in the class who actually had a nut allergy, and when he looked into the research, it actually turns out that there's good evidence that part of the reason why there's been a big spike in nut allergies is that students are increasingly not exposed to nuts at an early age for fear of nut allergies. So it's kind of, it's both a real example, but it's almost like a metaphor that essentially if you try to sort of protect your children too much, and there's a lot about parenting in the book, by the way, like that's something that people are a little bit surprised about, but it's really important to us. We talk a lot about parenting, that some of the attempts to shield our kids from things that make them uncomfortable can result in a lack of a sense of locus of control, which is a surefire way to produce more anxious and more depressed kids.
I notice you have a chapter in the book called The Decline of Play.
Yes.
What factors contributed to this trend, and what is the effect on young generations?
The Decline of Play chapter is honestly one of my favorite chapters in the whole book. And partially because when you're researching a book, there's parts that you come in kind of thinking you know a topic really well, and there's other ones that you have to do tons of research and you learn new things. And the role of the decline of play and how closely it's related to the spike in depression and anxiety is something that I've really come to believe, because when you talk to psychologists like Peter Gray, you realize that there's a reason why all mammals play, and part of it, and the reason why a lot of the play is risky, is partially to get you sort of used to functioning in the real world, so to speak, but to get comfortable with the anxiety and fear that everyday life produces. But when deprived of play, and there's a wonderful book by Erica Christakis called The Importance of Being Little that I really have to recommend, that talks about what I really have come to see is the tragedy of us pushing down academic topics from, say, fifth grade to pre-kindergarten, the kind of instruction where you're not actually, playing with paints and figuring out all this kind of stuff, but sitting with direct instruction, how harmful that can be for kids' creativity, for the sense of their own autonomy, all of these things that produce kind of happy kids who feel like they can take on the world. And when deprived of it, you shouldn't be surprised that you see this. And it really, this was the other thing. The play part really surprised me doing that research. The thing that horrified me while doing the research was how much anxiety and depression have gone up on campus, and suicide attempts, unfortunately, both on campus and nationally for younger people. And we think, at least in part, this is because we're ignoring simple things that help students develop a sense of competence, a sense of well-being, a sense of being able to function in the world.
That's a very important component to this whole discussion, which has really centered in the last few years over issues of free speech.
Yeah.
One of the things that you talk about in the book is how the issue of speech is often conflated with violence on college campuses. Why is that a bad idea?
Yep. Conflating speech with violence is something I've run into throughout my career, but it's taken off more recently, and just, you know, so your listeners know, I'm a First Amendment lawyer. I'm a my day job is defending free speech in general. I used to interned at the ACLU of Northern California. You know, I'm not an unbiased freedom of speech person. But the conflation of speech with violence, it makes a lot of sense intuitively, because it's obvious that sometimes, you know, some people's words to you can hurt you at such a level that it's almost like being punched in the face. I do understand why that's so seductive. But the problem is that people forget that for most of human history, there wasn't a meaningful distinction between the expression of an opinion, for example, and violence. Basically, most of human history is about getting beheaded for your opinions or getting ostracized, literally, in the sense of like being forced to leave the community, getting burned at the stake for expressing your heterodox opinions. And while it is true that it's an invention that we decided to make this bright line distinction between violence and the expression of opinions, it's in my opinion, one of the most important inventions the human race has ever come up with to promote thoughts, to promote pluralism, and this might be counterintuitive, but to promote peace. The theory of free speech is that the way you should solve things, the way you should solve disputes in a free, pluralistic democracy is not through resort to authority or resort to violence, but through argumentation rather than dueling and swords and all these other ghastly ways we tried to do it in the past.
Right. And one of the things I learned when I worked at the National Lawyers Guild and had the pleasure of working with Arthur Conoy for a few years, Arthur always said that the answer to speech that you disagree with is more speech, not the cessation of speech or the banning of speech. Am I wrong in thinking that a lot of the so-called coddling is taking place in elite private academic institutions?
Definitely, a lot of the trends that we see, where the students are kind of surprisingly anti-speech, do tend to take place in more elite institutions. It has been my experience. Now, this is something I always have to emphasize. I've started in this work in 2001, and by this work, I mean defending free speech on college campuses. And for almost my entire career, the single best constituency for free and unfettered speech, even if it's offensive, was always the students themselves. Always. And that really only started to change around 2012, 2013. And the book, frankly, is really about what happened. Like, where did this generational change take place? And it's still the case that we see this much more in more elite institutions. If you look at more working class institutions, they still have a sense of free speech being paramount and you don't have to agree with it. But I do think that there are lots of different reasons for why you would have students who are more pro, you know, enlightened censorship on some of these elite campuses than you would have now than you would have had maybe 15 years ago. And part of that, at least, is that we do increasingly live in more politically isolated communities, right down to the city blocks. So a lot of these students are coming from neighborhoods and backgrounds where there isn't a lot of, you know, political diversity or diversity of opinion. And when you get to campus, the clash of the different sort of echo chambers that we currently live in can get really intense. And so what I've seen, particularly since Trump has been elected, is sort of like the alt-right echo chamber on the one hand, and sort of like the echo chamber of higher education have finally sort of discovered each other, and sometimes the results can be really ugly.
Is it safe to say that progressives have played a large part in this sort of shift toward political correctness in speech and behavior on campus?
As someone who likes to consider themselves a political liberal myself, I would hate to say that, but I will say I've been disappointed, particularly in recent years, how often I am convincing people who I consider my fellow liberals that robust protections of speech are good, even if you don't benefit from it personally, even if it's not your opinion that's likely to be the one, you know, facing getting you expelled, you should protect it nonetheless. And these arguments usually lead to, you know, what if it's harassment? What if it's incitement? What if it's threats? And of course, I always come back to American free speech jurisprudence, which I'm not claiming is perfect, but a lot of it is a very well thought out way of how you have both freedom of speech and pluralism in the real world. So, you know, for example, harassment is not protected, threats are not protected, but there is one bedrock principle that you cannot get in trouble just because your opinion is considered to be offensive. There's no way, under the First Amendment, you can't ban someone's opinion because someone thinks it's aberrant. And that's one of the things that distinguishes the American system from almost any other in the world. But once again, you know, as a big proponent of what I call deep pluralism, I think that's something that you not just should accept, but kind of embrace, because the other option is believing that we're safer knowing less about what our fellow citizens actually think. And I think that the surprises of the election of 2016 showed us that, well, that ends up being a fool's errand, because then we end up thinking, oh, well, you know, this is going to be a cakewalk, and then next thing you know, we have President Trump.
You were on campus at Yale for the Halloween incident, if I read correctly.
Yep.
Can you briefly tell our listeners about that?
That was after Erica Christakis, who actually we talk about in the book in the context of her great writing on childhood development. That's actually her specialty. But she sent an email. It's actually kind of hard to talk briefly about because it ends up being so complicated. But she sent out an email that would have been, from someone from my generation, a defense of student autonomy, basically saying that students should be, it really shouldn't be the university's role to police what students wear for Halloween, because students should be able to resolve these issues themselves. And it was read by some students on campus to essentially say, you know, blackface or other offensive costumes are great, which is not at all. I always urge people to read the letter themselves, because that's not what the letter says. And it led to a pretty angry confrontation in the courtyard of Silliman College between Erica Christakis's husband, Nicholas Christakis, and angry students who wanted her to resign or to apologize. And so I was there for that, and having watched so many of these kind of controversies unfold over the years, I knew that if there wasn't, you know, evidence of someone of the fact that Professor Christakis maintained himself, didn't lose his temper, that this is usually the kind of case we see where a professor ends up getting fired. So we videotaped it. We wanted people to see. It's like, listen, this was a situation in which, yes, it was a heated discussion, but Professor Christakis, in my opinion, did an admirable job of keeping his cool during it. And the good news is that even though he eventually stepped down from Silliman College and his wife no longer teaches there, he's still a professor at Yale.
The last section of your book is called Wising Up. And you have some suggestions for parents. Can you share a few of those?
Well, for parents, you know, I have two children under 3 years old, so I'm getting a very firsthand taste of how hard some of these things can be. But among the more interesting you know, suggestions is really trying to find communities of like-minded parents who believe in what Lenore Skenazy coined as free-range parenting. That you have a community of parents who aren't going to, you know, report you to the cops if you let your student do things like we did as kids, which is walk to school, for example, or play outside with none or minimal supervision with their friends. All of these kind of things that we took for granted as kids, but didn't necessarily understand were actually so helpful to development. So what's amazing to me is how well established it is that free time, free play is so crucial for children. And meanwhile, when I look at the parents, you know, of the people who live in my neighborhood, it seems like they heard the exact opposite, because they schedule their kids from 6 a.m. to bedtime. And so in a sense, I feel like this is great news both for parents, because they're saying, listen, ease up a little bit. Let your kid run around with a string, you know, like go out and have fun and play. It's actually really good for them.
And what are some of your suggestions about wiser universities?
Oh, yeah, a lot of people lament, and this frustrates me, that's kind of like, oh, free speech on college campuses, it's doomed or whatever. And it's like, no, I've been doing this for years, and actually, you know, the court cases have been almost uniformly successful against universities imposing free speech zones. Still, about 30% of universities have what we consider to be a very bad speech code. So go to thefire.org, look up your alma mater, find if they have one of these speech restrictions. It turns out alumni telling presidents at universities can be very effective at getting universities to reform their codes. And, you know, probably the simplest change that I really am passionate about is in orientation, there should be a meaningful session on freedom of speech, on academic freedom, on freedom of inquiry that talks about the deep philosophy behind the fact that, in truth, we don't really know how much we know. In the grand scheme of things, we don't really know all that much. And that's why you need free speech, free inquiry, academic freedom.
I understand there's a case called Livingston that at Rutgers University. Can you briefly describe that?
Sure, absolutely. The details, you can look at thefire.org, but very simply, this is a white professor visiting Harlem. He teaches at Rutgers. He sees some white teenagers acting in what he considered to be sort of disrespectfully, and he goes on Facebook and he has a little bit of a rant about white gentrification and saying, for example, that I want to resign from the white race. Honestly, kind of, I used to live in Brooklyn, not untypical things to hear people saying, like in New York, but he was found guilty of racial harassment by Rutgers, because this was a white professor nominally harassing other white kids because of a political statement he made on Facebook. So this is an ongoing case currently at Rutgers, but one of the reasons why I got in trouble was because there were, you know, angry conservatives writing Rutgers saying you must punish this professor for his horrible racist speech. And the reason why I think people really need to know about this case is that has been the latest trend. It's liberal professors tweeting something or going on Tucker Carlson, one example, going on Fox News, and then next thing you know, they're either getting death threats or in some cases are losing their job due to the more conservative sort of outrage mob coming for them.
Greg, I have so many more questions, but we're running out of time, so I want to let our listeners know that you have a website, and I just love this name, thecoddling.com. It kind of sounds like a horror film.
That's exactly why we decided to name it that, is we wanted to kind of make a little bit of light of it, because we're like, oh, no, the coddling. And we're like, listen, everybody calm down. All we're saying is we might be doing some negative things by trying to help people sometimes.
Well, listeners can check out that website, and this is truly a wonderful book that adds so much to the discourse. It's called The Coddling of the American Mind, How Good Intentions and Bad Ideas Are Setting Up a Generation for Failure. So thank you so much, Greg, for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org.